Hello and welcome to this week's Standing with Refugees podcast, and thank you for joining us. I'm Paul Hutchings, one of the founders of Refugee Support Europe, and this week I'm talking to Bea Shrewsbury, who's one of our lovely trustees of Refugee Support Europe. Hello, Bea.
Hello, Paul. Hello.
I'm in Greece at the moment at one of the camps. Where are you in the world?
Well, I'm actually sitting in a very cold Palma de Mallorca at the moment, but thinking about Greece and thinking about Syria and all the awful things that are happening there at the moment.
Yes, the awful things still continue, don't they? Because you, I think you've come and volunteered on the refugee camps where we work in Greece three times now, am I right? And I think the first time was about a year ago, or was it longer than that?
No, it was January last year. It was my 60th birthday, and I thought I really have got to do something. And instead of celebrating my 60th birthday in the usual way, I decided to come to Greece, and I came for a month, and that's basically changed my life, I'd say. Mm. I think a lot more, even more about refugees than I did before.
Mm.
And and all the issues around how we tell people about who refugees are and why it's important to help them as well.
Mm. Mm. You say it's changed your life. I mean, it's changed how we work, because you've been brilliant at helping us to run the organisation, and you've been thinking about it. But in what way has it changed?
Well, as you know, my mum was a refugee herself, so I've obviously been very aware of the status of refugees all my life. Mm. But I've never actually positively gone out and done something about other people who are struggling. And because of me coming out to Greece, I now realise that you only have to do relatively small things to make big differences. Mm. And also, it does make you feel better about yourself. I have to admit that. So I guess it's slightly selfish as well that I feel that I've done something. But I've wanted to become much more involved on an ongoing basis, which is what I've done by becoming the trustee.
Mm. I think that subject comes up quite a lot when I talk to people about enjoying it. And it's just it's a bit of a curious, or, you know, feeling better about yourself, the sort of self-interest that goes with working in a situation like this, because it's not an easy job. It's tough. And you know, you're dealing with people who've got often far bigger problems than you have, or so it seems. And it seems a bit self-interested.
Yes, I agree to a certain extent. It's more that I suppose I felt guilty about not doing anything before, and now I don't feel so guilty. Yes, I often saying I've only got first world problems, and I realise how lucky I am to have the life I have, especially after the start that my mother had. But I would say it's not all about how you feel about yourself. It's also about how you make other people feel as well.
So important. And I mean, you mentioned your mum there. Let's talk about that, because you're here now because Britain at that time was instrumental in receiving, accepting and sheltering Jewish children from Germany and Austria.
Yes, yes, they did. And I mean, what's so amazing about my mother's experience is that she was born a Goldschmidt. Mm-hmm. And the only thing she ever did wrong was have the wrong name. Her family weren't religious. They lived as Germans in Germany. And this sort of thing is reflected in the Syrian refugee experience as well, that they just were living their lives. My mother was born in 1931. Her brother was born in 1936. And in 1939, my grandparents put their 8-year-old daughter and their 2-year-old son onto a train to come to the UK. And very fortunately, they were allowed to come to the UK because there were people willing to adopt them in the UK. And what's so amazing is that the person who adopted my mother was a 28-year-old pregnant lady who had been married just over a year. And when I think now about, you know, these people who did so much to help the children of refugees, and what's happening now, and the fact that people aren't allowed to do that in the UK anymore, makes me want to weep. You know, it's just incredible what happened to my mother and to the refugees at that time.
Yeah, I mean, I hear stories like that. It just makes me feel incredibly proud, even though it was all that time ago. And I, You wrote about your mum's experience, and it was on our website. We published it almost exactly a year ago, and I will post the link to that in the introduction to this podcast so that people can read that. But those were the things that struck me, were that, you know, suddenly these young kids had to leave, the sacrifice of your grandmother, and the trust and the heartbreak that must have involved. I mean, the fact that, you know, your mum and her brother were only 8 and 2 when they got on that train, and then just that young couple in Manchester, wasn't it, who opened their doors and absolutely did the right thing. And it just feels like we've lost something.
Yes, I totally agree. In fact, my mum just recently died, and we've been going through her things, and we found a most amazing letter from I call him uncle, but the guy, the husband, Hugh Bedford, who is a real war hero, I think. He wrote to my grandparents to say that my mother and her brother had arrived safely in the UK. And it's just such a lovely, lovely letter, which has been kept all these years, and nearly 80 years it's been kept. And I think it's a very precious letter.
Indeed. And I mean, this story is particularly poignant now, because I was also reading, you know, when you wrote that thing a year ago, that was also at the time when there was this Dubs Amendment for the UK to take in 3,000 unaccompanied children from Europe, and the government was dragging its feet. And still now, a year later, Help Refugees is taking the government to court to get them to implement the Dubs Amendment to receive just 3,000 unaccompanied minors.
Yes, well, I just don't understand the UK government. But I think part of it is there seems to be such a feeling against refugees at the moment, and I can't quite get my head around it. I think that people think that refugees are losers in this world. But if you just think about the imagination and the problem solving that's required by refugees to manage to get out of their country, and the tenacity of these people, they have to be good people to have working for you. And I know for my mother that she was very hardworking, and she was 8 and arrived in the UK not speaking English. And by the time she was 20, she'd graduated with a chemistry degree from London University. And, you know, and she worked all her life. And I think she's not atypical of a refugee.
And then she went on to have, was it 3 daughters and a brother?
Four daughters, and we're all very strong women. And I can't imagine why.
That's great.
Yeah, my mum was, she's pretty amazing. In fact, I'm sitting here on the desk. There's a photo which we found of my mum with holding her brother, who must be just under around about 6 months old. Mm. It's just such a beautiful photo. Mm. And just a year after that, the two of them were together again on the train, leaving Germany, leaving everything they knew.
Your mum's brother, your uncle, cope with the whole experience?
Well, unfortunately, my uncle was caught up in Kristallnacht, which was, even though he was only a very small baby, it did traumatise him. But he, despite that, he has had a few psychological problems, but they've been fairly minor. He's been very successful himself. He lives in New Zealand now, and he has two grown-up sons with 4 grandchildren. And he had a very successful career far on with the agricultural MAF, what were they called? Anyway, in New Zealand, he was an inspector. Mm. And he found his place in the world, and was also hardworking.
Mm. And then there's all of that. And then you said earlier that you see a kind of parallel with the experience of your mum and uncle with the people in Syria at the moment.
Oh, very much so. Mm. I actually was very privileged to be able to talk with one or two of the refugees when I was in Greece in enough detail to understand what their lives were like in Syria before the war, and to find out that they're just like you and me, and they had just had normal lives. And when the trouble started there was no obvious side to fight on, and just like my grandparents, their thought was to get their children to safety, and they had to escape with nothing My mother left Germany with just a tiny little suitcase, and likewise, these people left Syria with very little. And funnily enough, when I showed a photo of my mother to one of them, he said, "Oh, that could be my mother," because even though my mother's Jewish and he's a Muslim, a Syrian, they have very similar facial features. They come from the same, they have similar genes, I guess, just like we all do. We're all connected, aren't we? Mm. Now, sadly, for the Syrians, though, their situation isn't as good as my mother's ended up being, because they are stuck in refugee camps, which my mother was very fortunate not to find herself.
Did your mum's parents and wider family survive?
Her grandparents didn't, and sadly they died. But fortunately, both my grandparents did get out of Germany, as did my grandparents. Several of my grandparents' brothers and sisters got out of Germany too, and they scattered around the world. Sadly, my grandfather died when he was quite young. He was 67 when he died, and I'm sure that that was partially due to his experiences in the camp. But he did eventually manage to get out, partially because he had fought in the First World War on the German side, so they did an prisoner swap with the UK. So he did actually manage to get out of Germany.
Great. So you've been doing lots of stuff to support, you know, the work that we do, and that's been great. And one of those things has been organising a walk and talking about people getting out of countries. What we're going to try and do is replicate some of the walk that people made from Greece into the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia before the borders shut. Where did that idea come from, Bea?
Well, I've been puzzling about how. Part of it is because I've been puzzling about how to do fundraising, and something that might catch the eye but also be very relevant to what I'm raising funds for. And one morning I just woke up with this light bulb, and I said, I know what I should do. I should walk the refugee route through Europe. And my husband said to me, you are totally bonkers. But anyway, I thought about it a bit more, and I talked to you about it, and you actually thought that it was a good idea too. Thank you, Paul. But then I started talking to Skyline and to other people about it, and just put something on Facebook and seemed to get quite a lot of interest in joining me in the walk. And it has grown legs, so to speak. And now we've got 17 walkers, I believe, is that right?
34 legs.
Yeah. 34 legs, yes. We're not quite a millipede yet, but yes, I'm really excited about it because it's going to be very poignant. We're going to go to Edamini, which was the largest unofficial camp in Greece at one time, and I don't know it, but I'm really looking forward to, well, looking forward to, is that the right word? But I'm glad that we're going to go and look at that and hopefully stand and think about why that camp grew up and what it means. And then,
I think, I mean, that's a good place to start, I think, because I went there the beginning of April 2016, when there was still an awful lot of people there, probably at that time about 10 or 11,000. And they'd got there because that was the route that a lot of them were walking and then going through the former Republic of Macedonia, and borders shut. They basically put up barbed wire fences, and then the Macedonian military were on the other side there preventing people. And then the numbers just built up, and it was disgusting. Quagmire, people in tents, I just saw the most horrific things. And also when I was there, tear gas, concussion grenades, stone throwing. It was just a brutal, brutal place to be. And I think it really symbolised at that time, I think, the refusal of Europe to receive people who were fleeing war and conflict and inflicting on them the kind of misery that they were running away from.
Yes. Actually, on that point, there's something I'd like to say, because we're all just a stone throw or a bomb away from being a refugee. Mm. And the number of refugees are going to increase, not just because of war, but because of famine, because of climate change. And the number of refugees are going to increase. We have got to find a solution to this. We've all got to campaign for a solution to this and to be generous and do all the things that we like in other people, generosity and hospitality and warmth and wisdom. I mean, why have we got to this? I just don't understand. But anyway, that's why, yes, going on this walk and seeing and remembering that when we get to the camp is so important, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think being so close to, you know, we could all of us be refugees. I mean, you know, some people say, "Well, it'll never happen here," but I mean, that's exactly what, you know, happened in Syria. I mean, still now, I mean, I meet Syrians and they seem bewildered that this has happened to them. You know, that older generation, they were living their lives, so things were, as far as they could see, great, and then all of a sudden it just fell apart. They had to run away, and that's why Idomeni, I think, was particularly poignant, because, you know, that it was the same in Yugoslavia. I mean, Yugoslavia didn't think that they were all going to start slaughtering each other, and that's exactly what happened. People had to up sticks and settle somewhere else, and there it was. You know, it was mostly Syrians who had arrived at that border, not being allowed to move on.
Yes. Well, particularly poignant. Mm. That was so recent too. Something in Europe, so recent. But we then have to walk to the one and only crossing, I believe, between Greece and the Republic of Macedonia. I believe there's only one place you can cross now. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah. So you can no longer cross Idomeni. I mean, that shut a couple of years ago, so we have to go somewhere else. But we're going to start at Idomeni. So, I mean, I haven't been there since then, but my guess is that it's still a lot of razor wire and fencing with, you know, towers and being patrolled. So we'll be crossing somewhere else and then walking through the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. I have to keep saying that because Greece lays claim to the state of Macedonia, and they get incredibly upset if we call the country Macedonia when they believe Macedonia is Greek. So get that one out of the way.
Yes.
we're then going to walk through and walk to Skopje, and we're starting on the 29th. Is that right?
29th, yes. Sunday the 29th. So our first night is there.
Yeah.
On the 29th.
Then we'll on the 30th we get a coach to Idomeni, and then we'll start walking from there. And then we'll be walking all week until we get to Skopje.
Yes. And we're walking through what looks like to be beautiful mountains and alongside the lake, one of the big lakes that's in that amazing looking country. And so from being selfish, I'm really looking forward to going over the mountains as well. So it's going to be a beautiful walk as well as a very poignant walk.
I think it's all good. It's like you say, we've got beautiful mountains. It's a great time of year. I mean, that time of year, it'll be warm, but not too hot. It'll be sunny. But walking by the lakeside, we're retracing the steps. We'll be raising awareness that the crisis affecting refugees in Europe hasn't gone away. And I mean, you know, having been here for 2 years now and seen how the crisis has developed, and I'm not going to call it a refugee crisis, it's a European crisis that's affected refugees. And you know, back in those early days of Idomeni, when people were living in these dreadful kind of muddy conditions with tents and no food, you know, when they first arrived in the camps where we were working, they were suffering from malnutrition. A lot of those problems have gone away. You know, now I'm here, you know, we're here in near Ioannina on a camp where people have ISO boxes and they do have enough food. It's not great, they don't have much, but they have, you know, no one's starving, and they have somewhere, many people have somewhere to live. It's different on the islands, but here on the mainland, those conditions aren't bad, but there is still a crisis. I was talking to somebody yesterday who doesn't have an interview until May next year. So they're going to be waiting 15 months until they get an interview. What are they supposed to do? They're waiting.
What are they supposed to do?
Whoa.
Yeah, your life just has to go on hold, doesn't it? Mm. Yeah, it's just, as you say, it's a European crisis, not knowing how to deal with the refugees, which to me seems like it's a no-brainer what to do. Mm. But, thank goodness for refugee support is all I can say.
Well, it's yes, and thank goodness there's so many people from around the world who are willing to come and do what they can to help. And this is where I kind of shake my head and wonder sometimes, because you know when we were talking about Britain 80 years ago now, crikey, so doing what they can,
80.
80 years ago, doing what they can to take in refugees and working hard to do that. You know, there's still good people like that who, you know, that, you know, you and I have met them. There's hundreds of people who are working really hard. They're coming out to the camps, or they're running in their own communities, you know, looking, making sure people have got housing, helping them into education, sorting, you know, helping with languages. And on the other side, we seem to have this narrative in the newspapers that they're scroungers. We're too full. We can't accept them. It's dangerous. You know, why don't they stay in their own country? It's a wicked contrast.
It is a wicked contrast indeed. Yeah, actually, that's one of the things that you've just reminded me that has... I was very, very depressed, I suppose. Not depressed in a medical sense, but just feeling like everything was hopeless. And going to help at the camp and meeting the people who were helping. And also because of the fundraising and trying to find things to take to Greece before I left, I have met so many wonderful people who are helping. All sorts of people, not just refugees, but homeless people, and doing such wonderful work here on the island of Majorca and in the UK. And it's made me feel very much more positive. And the young people I met, the young volunteers I met, and actually the young refugees themselves, they're so bright and they're so aware of things, and actually politically aware as well. It made me feel positive, a lot more positive about the future than I had previously been. So I suppose that's another way that the refugees have helped, going to help the refugees has helped me, and made me think differently, a bit more differently about life and the future.
Totally with you on that one, because if I wasn't doing this, I would be going mad screaming at the telly. And it's just been great to be around people who are like-minded. And I think that's another great reason to go on the walk if you're thinking about doing it, is to be with you know, a bunch of other people who feel like you. And I just know that, you know, I don't know everybody personally, I know some of them on that walk, but I just know that everyone's going to get along. It's just going to be a kind of, you know, a very positive together solidarity experience.
Yes, I believe so too. Actually, I've had one or two people saying that they're concerned about raising the funds. Mm. And it is hard. Mm. It is hard. I'm the first to admit that. And one of the hardest things is actually getting over the shyness of asking people to contribute, even if it's only a small amount. I think a lot of people don't like talking about money, and you just once you've got over that shyness, then actually people keep, they'll say, oh, I keep meaning to, and they actually don't get around to it. But if you actually specifically ask them to donate, then they'll remember to do it. So I think that's one thing I'd like to say about that. But, you know, I can only talk from personal experience here. But another thing, which for me, I've been lucky that I had a birthday in January, and it was the same for my 60th birthday. I just asked people not to give me birthday presents, but to donate to refugee support. Mm. And actually, a lot of people were very generous doing that. And obviously, that's a personal preference. But another thing that I've done, which to help raise money, is I've actually sold things I don't need or want anymore.
Oh,
but
good idea.
I think somebody else might like. And I've asked people to make donations to refugee support, and I give them something which I might have thrown away otherwise, or given away otherwise. But also you could ask your kids, if you've got kids, to go do a bit of fundraising, bake some cakes and have a cake stall and things like that. So I'm wondering if maybe we should share a few fundraising ideas like that, because I'm sure other people have ideas as well of ways of raising funds.
Yep. Well, your employer is a good one as well. Some employers have got a matched giving scheme, so that immediately kind of takes care of a good proportion of what you need to raise. If you're a UK taxpayer, there's gift aid on top of that. So that number is already coming down quite a bit when all those things are taken into consideration. And one of the walkers, Natalie, who's very enterprising, has got in touch with a travel company, and she's offered to write a regular blog about the walk, and they've given her pretty much the whole lot.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah,
what a good idea.
Yeah. So, okay. You know, I think a bit of chat, and we would, you know, we will always provide photos, stories, support, you know, whatever you need to help you with raising money as well.
Yes, it's just not being frightened to ask, really, isn't it?
Great. That's
Okay.
really good. Thank you very much, B.
You're welcome.
And thank you I'm going to say publicly thank you for all that you've done as a charity trustee. It's a responsible job, and you've kind of really grabbed it with both hands and done loads to support us, and really appreciate that. It's fantastic, the help and the advice that you've given us. So thank you for that, and thank you for standing with refugees. Thank you to everyone for listening. We talk to someone every week and make it available to download on Mondays. You can subscribe on Podbean and iTunes. You can download it. You can find it on our website. Please tell us what you think. You can email me, paul@refugeesupport.eu. If you do a search, you'll also find us on Facebook, which is Refugee Support Europe. You'll find us on Twitter and Instagram. Both of those are really lively, run by Andrew and Frederica. And if you've got any suggestions about who we can also talk to, then please let us know. Thank you very much.